The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
In the book, Until Justice and Peace Embrace, Nicholas Waltersdorf describes true discipleship as world-formative Christianity. Included in that is the reformation of the social world. Christians are called, he says, to struggle for the healing and the wholeness of society at home and abroad. And now we know it's no longer an option, never should have been, to do this simply at home, nor to engage the larger world only through occasional missions, conferences, and support monies, good as those things might be. But we really are called to struggle for the healing and wholeness of global society. I first found out about the Institute for Global Engagement from a British friend, Tim Dean, then a senior programmer for BBC World Services. He came over across the ocean, stayed with us in order to participate in this, and he came back with rave reviews about what he had seen that day. At his recommendation, I picked up a copy of the Brandywine Review of Faith and International Affairs, and I've been hooked on it ever since. It's the most extraordinary, unique review. I couldn't believe there was a Christian organization doing this with such balance and depth. Well, Chris Seipel is president of the Institute for Global Engagement. The IGE is a think tank with legs. It promotes sustainable environments for religious freedom worldwide. As a faith-based organization, IGE believes firmly in universal human dignity and is committed to the protection of all faiths through the rule of law. IGE pursues this mission with a balanced approach, encouraging governments to protect religious freedom, or what it calls top-down engagement, and equipping citizens to exercise that freedom responsibly, bottom-up or grassroots engagement. They believe that religious pluralism is the best way forward, not in spite of, but because of Christian principles. Chris travels where few evangelicals will be found. He might be in the northwestern frontier province of Pakistan, where Al-Qaeda is hiding. He might be in Bethlehem with Palestinian Christians who are victims several times over. Or in Uzbekistan, helping with the post-Cold War realities of life there. As a Marine Corps officer, Chris established the Humanitarian Operations Chair at Marine Corps University in Quantico, Virginia. And he served as a service representative and writer on the staff of the congressionally mandated National Defense Panel. Chris serves on the board of Wycliffe Bible Translators. He's a member at the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, and he's a founder of the IGE's Council on Faith and International Affairs. He's the author of The U.S. Military and NGO Relationship in Humanitarian Interventions. Most importantly and most significantly, Chris is a lover of the world's best game, which is called soccer. So we welcome him with enthusiasm, and thank you for taking time from your very busy schedule to be with us. Please welcome Chris Seipel.
Good morning, Westminster. You know, these are difficult and desperate times if a former Marine is addressing a seminary. But bear with me. Before I get started, a few caveats in thinking about how we do things and how IG works. And it might be best if I turn my BlackBerry off. We can go from there. Yeah, there's a certain peace that comes with that. I want you to know where I'm coming from on this stuff before we and start talking about these things. One is I come at it as a scholar practitioner. I respect scholarship, don't get me wrong, but my heart is practitioner, and that's where I'm coming from. And in many ways, what I'm going to speak about today is not anything I've actually read, and forgive me, I haven't read a lot of theology, as will probably quickly become evident. But it's just me thinking and interacting with the world as it is. And me as someone who takes faith seriously, someone who takes international relations seriously, trying to meld the two. And you need to know that that's where I'm coming from in terms of my perspective. And as such, what it represents then is a sort of a midstream reflection. IGE is on an 8-year journey. We're young. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've got a lot of mistakes to go. But I want to share with you in midstream, in real time, here are some thoughts from a guy who takes Christ, is passionate about Christ, and is passionate about his world. And I want to tell you the framework under three parts of my presentation. There's a little bit about the Institute. The framework under which I think we operate. This is where I'm going to dare to delve into theology a little bit. And then show you some pictures about what it actually looks like. And in particular, I want to focus on the Muslim world, as that is, I think, the number one issue of our time. And if our faith isn't real in the Muslim world, in places like Pakistan or the Holy Land, then why believe? We have to have some sort of model for engagement. So that's where I'm coming from. Let's go to the next slide. The Institute, what do? Bill summarized it very well, and I'm grateful for that. We do religious freedom. We do religious freedom because we think it's consistent with kingdom theology. You work on behalf of your brother and sister made in the image of Christ, irrespective of whether he or she is a believer, such that they have the right to choose or not choose faith freely. And we find that religious freedom is a Big Ten issue. It's neither Republican or Democrat. If you're from the Abrahamic traditions especially, there's a lot of theology behind taking that perspective. And you can find people hold that perspective in the Hindu and Buddhist traditions as well. The question is, everybody's for religious freedom. How can you be against it? But what does that look like in a particular context? We don't use words like democracy or human rights or even religious freedom sometimes, to be honest. Those words, whether you like it or not, are often viewed as disguise for American hegemony around the world and empire. So what we like to say is we work at the intersection of rule of law and culture, consistent with the former and sensitive to the latter. Rule of law in the sense that religious freedom should be legally protected as a universal right. Culture such that it can be culturally owned and therefore sustainable. And the balance as you deal with self-interest is that rule of law is needed because most of the folks of Asian authoritarianism need rule of law to join WTO. And why do they want to join WTO? Because they all have a youth bulge. And they need the jobs. They got to figure that out. Otherwise, they're going to have social instability, something very not desired in group-based societies. But culture sometimes is an apology, not for working for universal principles. We don't do this in the East, or this, that, or the other. My whole feeling, and we're going to get into this, is that in every culture, there is a mechanism for respect. A mechanism for respect, not just tolerance. And that's what you have to work within and in that context. That's the redemptive analogy for religious freedom. So we do relational diplomacy. We work top-down and bottom-up, government and grassroots. We're always transparent about who we are. We're Christian in motivation. We're very clear about that. But we say we're nonpartisan and we're non-proselytizing. That puts people at ease. I suspect that there are some folks not from America in this room. And they're probably familiar with the baggage that comes with A, being American, and B, being evangelical. If this is a newsflash to you, let me just briefly share that the word evangelical is a dirty word in a lot of places in the world, especially Bethlehem. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But you have to find ways to engage in a way that is true to who you are, but doesn't close the door before you knock. That's why we're called the Institute for Global Engagement. That's a very intentionally bland name. We're not the Institute for the Persecuted Church or the Institute for Religious Freedom. It can be too bland. Sometimes people think we're an international dating service, which, hey, if that's what you think, that's okay. We're working for global polygamy. But no. All right, so we're a think tank with legs, a think and do tank if you're feeling less than poetic, which is often my marine nature. And that's what we do is a religious freedom. But how do you think about engaging the world? You have to be educated. You have to be equipped. And I would say this is the number one need in the world today. The number one need in the world is actually for the church. And the church is the least equipped to engage the world. And the church has to get back to discipleship. That's where you guys come in. Because you're being prepared to be shepherds. Not just so you can be missiologically correct, but for such that you can make the timeless message timely in all walks, all spheres, all vocations. So how do you think about that? How do you find make yourself relevant without being relativistic? It's a fine line to walk, and it takes some thinking. And you can't just go out and have a quantitative metric for what success looks like. So we've done two things to understand and think through education. One is we've created the Council on Faith International Affairs. As Bill mentioned, we publish a journal, the Review of Faith International Affairs. We dropped the Brandywine because nobody knew what it meant, even though it was a really cool name. So it's just the Review now. And as examples of what we do, it's multi-faith to include people of no faith in terms of authors and in terms of the board of advisors and the contributing editors. The last issue, we did a focus on evangelicals in Israel-Palestine. Just taking on garden variety things, you know. No opinions. And then the one that we did that just came out yesterday is on African-American churches and how they engage the world. I'm biased, but I think these things are cutting edge, and they're meant to be accessible to both scholar and practitioner. And to be frank, we started it to prove that evangelicals could write with footnotes. Because there was no place for faith international affairs people to talk to each other. And I was at the Fletcher School working on my PhD, and I took my faith seriously, and where I went to church and all those things, there wasn't people who were thinking about international relations and geopolitics and economics. But I get in those spheres, and there's nobody who talks about religion, because religion is part of the problem, right? We all know that. We're all secular fundamentalists in the academy. So how do you deal with that? Of course, the other cultural issue is religion and politics are the two things you've been taught not to talk about since childhood. The bummer of it all is that your global society and global security exist at their intersection. So you've got to know how to talk about religion and politics, and the church has to be relevant, as was intended. The last thing that the Institute does is we have a program called GEN, or the Global Engagement Network. And this is designed to challenge and equip Christians about how they engage the world. It's designed to challenge them to claim the admonition of Christ to be shrewd as snakes and innocent as doves. As Bill said to me last night, we need more snakes. Great op-ed title. But we do need more snakes. Christians are arguably innocent. They are unarguably not shrewd, if that makes any sense, if I got the double negative right. We're not very good at being shrewd. We're not very good at understanding local politics, about harnessing self-interest, about working with the local mayor, the local whoever, because we're so focused on conversion as opposed to conversation and showing social justice as a form of evangelicalism. And I would argue that we are an evangelical organization, but we're a non-proselytizing one. That makes my Asian authoritarian friends, whether Islamist or communist, feel good, and they can talk to me. But what they don't realize, at least in my theological world, is I'm not proselytizing, which is to say I'm not having a direct sharing of the faith per the four spiritual laws or whatever I have for a tract bomb, but I am evangelizing. I am living out a very different type of faith because for most, if not all, of these people, they have a negative stereotype of what Christians are and evangelicals are. So by seeing me, they see something different, as imperfect and as frail and fragile as I am. There's something different from the stereotype that they have as you engage the cruel edges of the world. The purpose of the Institute is this, to make Christ visible and Christians relevant on the cruel edges of the world. That's from Hebrews 11, the Eugene Peterson translation. Religious freedom is how we do it. Education is how we do it. Okay, this is the meaning of life according to Disciple. And I'm going to spend maybe 20 minutes or so on this, and then we'll get to the pictures. This is how I think about life on the right-hand side. I think all of life can kind of be grouped into those four categories: theology, civil society, geopolitics, and economics. I'll say the theology for the next point. These points here, civil society, geopolitics, economics, and the issues that are incumbent therein, and these are just illustrative examples, they have two common points of definition for all of us, whether we're Christian or non-Christian. The first one is that no single state or non-state entity can handle them by themselves. And if you have any doubt about this, look at Department of Defense in Iraq. That's the biggest state entity out there, $500 billion, and it can't do it alone. That's not a put down in the Pentagon. I used to work there. There's good people there. But it's a reality. And we don't like to deal with those kinds of realities because we're all stuck in our own little silo or stovepipe, whether it's missions or whether it's national security or whatever. But there's a fundamental wisdom in that. No single state or non-state entity can handle the global challenges that we face alone. The second reality, therefore, is that it is not a question of if, but when you will partner with another organization or state. It's that simple. It has profound implications for how you think about your theology of engagement. Profound. Now, the third characteristic of all those global challenges that we face is this theological one. God is already there. God is already at work. It's your call whether you choose to find the time to pray about it and seek the wisdom and discernment to come alongside what Jesus is already doing. Because if you do that, then you'll end up working with God. If you don't do that and you rush off in a typical American sense, ready, fire, ready, aim, with all the answers, you're going to end up working for God and wasting a lot of time and money and probably tarnishing the name of the one who sent you. So those are the three characteristics of the global challenges we face. So that brings us back to the theology. And here's where I welcome all of your eminent and erudite feedback, because I'm not a theologian, nor do I play one on TV. But I want you to think about what globalization is and these three points under theology, because I think as American evangelicals in particular, and this is my own experience, I don't want to speak for anybody here in the audience, we've set up false juxtapositions. So the first juxtaposition is that we don't do globalization, or we should be scared of that, or NAFTA, or however you want to frame it, all the social injustice and the haves and the have-nots, the rich are getting rich, whatever. So we're just going to stay in our comfortable Christian kumbaya cocoon and you know, politics is dirty, the world is dirty. I think that's absolutely biblically false to think that way. Globalization is inherent to what God intended. God invented globalization. So we need to embrace it, and we need to think about it. This age has particular characteristics, but think about it theologically. I got to thinking about this a couple of years ago after I'd heard a Christian of some reputation, his whole reference point in explaining globalization was Tom Friedman. You know, globalization 1.0, 2.0. And I think that starts with 1492 or something like that, you know, some simplified form of history that ignores all of Asian history. It's Columbus is the point of reference as opposed to the Chinese fleets off the east coast of Africa. But that's another story, right? And globalization 1.0 is Genesis 1 and 2. An ecosystem holistic perspective about how to think about the world, the interrelated nature. Genesis 2, we're called to name things. The first part of wisdom is to name things properly so you can engage and take responsibility for dominion. 2.0, I would argue, is Genesis 12 and the reconciliation that God enacts through Abram after Babel. 3.0 is the Great Commission. And before he gives the Great Commission, Christ says what? All things in heaven and earth are under my authority. I'm already there. I don't need you, by the way, but I'm already there and I long for you to come by my side and help me out. 4.0 is revelation. I would suggest that's a very different framework for thinking about things, especially if your framework for success is not defined by how many hands are raised for Jesus or how many souls you baptized, but because you're trying to be obedient. So embrace globalization. That's point number one. Second is mission. There's a lot of talk, as I understand it, in evangelical circles about, is it missions or missional or whatever the case is. My two-cent thing as an infantry guy is mission. You stay on mission. And what is mission? To make the timeless message timely. We're all missionaries. Every vocation, any location. Don't you dare reduce my king to the Lord of missiology. That's what we got to recover. Because what's taking place in our evangelical cocoon? Sunday is a spectator event sport. You go and you watch and I feel good about myself and I'm home. And then missions is what? Something that takes place over there. And if you've, like me, growing up in a great evangelical church, you have Wednesday night potluck dinners and paper plates and plastic forks and you receive the slideshow, which has now been upgraded to PowerPoint, and success is that 10 people were saved as this missionary reports. There's no reporting on follow-up, i.e. discipleship. It's just that the souls were saved. That's success. Stay on mission. Your mission is to make the timeless message timely. As pastors, you're to steward your flock and shepherd your flock and listen to all the different vocations that are sitting in your pew waiting to be mobilized. Your job is going to be to equip them to engage the culture and therefore transform it. But if you're in this missiological box, you're going to be irrelevant. Okay, so then the question becomes to my mind, how do you love? How do you love your neighbor? Because that's what it all boils down to, is the culture of the cross, right? Being a vertical right relationship with God, so therefore you can be in a horizontal relationship with your neighbor. That's the culture of the cross. Love God, love people. But if you can't love in a language and logic that your neighbor understands, that is recipient-based, then my case is you're not loving. You need to love people in a way they understand. And when you engage a culture, you have to do it that way. And again, as I read the gospel, I just look at Jesus. He had one message, right? Know me. If you want to boil all the gospel down, it's that. Know me. Be in a right relationship with me. But the methodology changed according to the circumstances. He was making the timeless message timely according to the audience. Who else can get away with saying, if you're not for me, you're against me? Matthew 12:30, and saying, if you're not against us, you're for us. Mark 9:40. Totally inconsistent, but was based on the context of the audience to whom Jesus was speaking. One was Pharisees, the other was potential disciples acting in his name. You have to be thinking about these things. So the question, therefore, is not what would Jesus do, but what is Jesus doing? I've never been asked the question overseas, what would Jesus do? Don't get me wrong. It's a nice moral anchor point as we engage our own culture. But in some ways, it's a question for an affluent cocoon that has too much time on its hands. You got to come alongside what Jesus is doing. And he's doing something through Christian and non-Christian and all the Cyruses out there, Isaiah 44:45, in all of these global challenges. Right now, this day. And because he's God, he doesn't need you. We got to keep remembering that. But if you're in right relationship with him, it is our privilege, precious privilege, to be used by him. So what does it look like when you try to work on these issues? These are all the factors that are going to be there. And they can be changed and whatever. But you got the UN and IOs, international organizations, NGOs, non-governmental organizations. The difference between the two is an international organization is made up of member states. NGOs are truly non-governmental. Faith and religion, and I think there's a difference. Culture, the government where you're working, all these things are there. It's this hodgepodge ecosystem perspective that you've got to deal with if you want to engage the world as it is, if you want to make the timeless message timely. So how do you do that? Come back to love God, love people. And the way I think about it is this L-O-V-E thing called, in terms of how you practice relational diplomacy. You have to listen and you have to observe. And I think that takes place at three levels. You're listening and observing to God, listening for his voice, observing how he's moving in your life. And then you're thinking about it in terms of your own self. Why have I been given the passions and skills that I've been given? Why do I have these interests? Why do I feel like I should be doing something? And then third level is that you're looking and listening and observing to that culture that you feel called to engage. And that culture is not some thing over there. It could be down the street. There are very few ethno-singular cities with only one ethnicity in it anymore in America, if any. There are minorities all over the place of all colors. So how do we engage that? Well, global engagement starts at home, and you have to think about how you engage that neighbor. I've had a lot of conversations lately with African-American pastors about how they interpret text and how me, from my white background, interpret text. It's amazing to me how different we can be. It's sad because the conversation hasn't taken place. And yeah, you can say, well, you grew up here, you grew up there, and don't beat yourself up, blah, blah, blah. More diversity means more beauty. It's what God intended. You have to be intentional about seeking these things out. So listen and observe at those three levels with God. Test these things. Be in relationships of accountability. And then verify. And what I mean by verify is just check. Do I have the facts straight? I don't want to scare you and say don't engage and you got to read 3,000 books and do so many interviews and whatever. I'm not saying that at all. But you have to do a little bit of listening and observing at those three levels and then verify and double check with people who love you so much they'll tell you the truth. Some of you maybe don't belong at seminary. Get your butt out and go out and do what you're called to do. Some of you better finish up quick because you're needed now with your degree. And then engage, and then engage, and engage unabashedly. The one thing I've learned in our travels as I've engaged the world is Christ is truly there, and Christ is truly wanting to teach me something before I have any actual impact. Every conversation I've been with a communist or Islamist official praying about what to say, you know what his response has been probably 9 times out of 10? Shut up. Just listen. See the strategy and the plan that I've revealed. Come alongside and work with it. I'll show some illustrations of that in a second. Now, lastly, what I want to say about this slide is at the middle of it, how do you relate to all these people? Yeah, you're listening and observing and then engaging, but what's the key for building something? What's the key for building a partnership of state and non-state actors that addresses these global issues? What does love really look like? And I think that word is respect. Respect is a very different word than the word of tolerance, which is associated with all the international covenants. Now, don't get me wrong here. Tolerance is a good word. It's accepted. But I think we live in an age where tolerance is not good enough. Tolerance means I allow for your presence. I don't have to talk to you. But I allow for your presence. Respect says, I want to get to know you enough to respect who you are as a child of God, irrespective of whether you believe the same way as I do. I think religious freedom is about respect. I think respect is about what it really means to love your neighbor. No neighbor is going to respond to the proclamation of the word unless he feels or she feels respected by you. I can't tell you how much condescension and arrogance comes in the proclamation of the word. If you have any doubt about that, read Lamb Sana's book, Whose Christianity is Religion? Whose Religion is Christianity? And how it was spread, and the word succeeds despite its point of origin in Christendom in the West. Show respect. And as a teaser tonight for you, Bill, just for you. I've got a quote that I want to relate back to peace and justice. And that quote is this. It's from Pope Paul VI. You don't mind if I quote a Catholic here, do you? I have a lot of respect for Catholics as I've grown in my own faith in the Universal Church. But on January 1st, 1972, in the Peace Day Address, Pope Paul VI famously said, if you want peace, work for justice. And his reference point was Isaiah 32:17, which is this, the effect of righteousness or justice will be peace, and the result of righteousness, quietness and trust forever. Now, this is what the Pope said at that time. A peace that is not the result of true respect for man is not true peace. And what do we call this sincere feeling for man? We call it justice. So, if you want reconciliation, work for peace. If you want peace, work for religious freedom. If you want religious freedom, work for respect. If you want respect, work for justice. It's all related in how we engage the world around us. And we can take up some of those things at the panel session tonight. Okay. Mr. Magoo's World Travels, slide number one. In case you don't recognize this man, he, at the time, was the number six ranking elected official in Pakistan. His name is Chief Minister Akram Durrani. And he was elected freely with some rigging in 2002 on a platform of anti-Americanism and pro-Sharia. So your first question and my first question is I wouldn't be caught dead in the picture. It's not too hard to find Waldo. But before I go through the slides and show you the practical impact about that, I want to, one, set the context for what it means to engage the Muslim world. I do think this is the number one issue of our time, whether you think about it from a national security perspective or whether you think about it as a dare to love, a dare to understand and respect your neighbor and to love them in a language and logic they understand. If you travel anywhere in the Muslim world, the relationship between America and the Muslim world, between Christian and Muslim, is significantly, deeply poisoned. The only thing that's going to break that cycle is the love of Christ. And it ain't going to be kumbaya evangelicalism out of the suburbs. It's going to be a hardcore love that is not afraid to go to the cruel edges of the world and say, we love you no matter what. We can disagree with you honestly, but we love you no matter what. Now, this is not just me talking anecdotally. Let me give you some facts and figures from all the Gallup polling that's taking place. And if you're interested in engaging the Muslim world whatsoever, I encourage you to get a book that just came out by a couple friends of mine, John Esposito and Dalia Mugahead, called Who Speaks for Islam? It's very readable, it's very accessible, it's based on Gallup polling of 35 or 40,000 Muslims in 35 or 40 countries around the world. This is a no-kidding assessment of how they are thinking about things and how they see us. And the fact, obviously, that perception is reality. But here are some stats from that. And about Americans ourselves. 22% of us say that we don't want a Muslim neighbor. Just under 50% of us believe Muslims are not loyal to our country. If I can read my own handwriting. 46% of Americans hold a negative view of Muslims. 32% say there's nothing to admire in Islam. 57% of Americans know nothing or very little about Islam itself. Now tell me, if you're a Muslim living in America or anywhere else in the world, are you going to feel respect? It's mathematically impossible, given those numbers. And I'm not making a comment here on what we think about Islam or anything. These are just facts about perceptions of how Muslims feel and how Americans feel about Muslims. There's a total disconnect between Christianity and Muslims, and as ambassadors for Christ, we are called to
engage them and to love them. It's so bad that in understanding the gap between Muslims and Christians, 54 to 57% of Muslims think the reason for the gap is, you guessed it, respect. The same percentage of Americans, guess what reason they think is why the gap exists? Public relations. It's just a PR problem. They just understood us better. They love us because we love us. But the Muslim in this country and around the world does not feel respected. Now, you can give me all kinds of reasons, well, this, that, and the other, and culture of victimology, and no access to information, and Arab authoritarian. Hey, that's all window dressing. They need to be loved just like your neighbor next door. So how are you going to address that? How are you going to engage that? So back to my favorite Islamist, Akram Durrani. I had a friend from Reading, Pennsylvania, a Christian believer from Punjab, Pakistan, come to me at the end of 2003 when our organization was still located at Eastern College. We're in the gatehouse, if you're familiar with the campus at the back entrance there. And he said, this is a year after this guy was elected on the anti-American pro-Sharia platform. And he comes in and says, hey, I don't know what you guys do, but I think you build bridges. How would you like to meet a friend of mine? He's an Islamist. And I got to tell you, I reacted as somebody with all kinds of stereotypes, beyond the fact that I was concerned for my own safety. Who in the right mind would go to Peshawar, Pakistan, which is the birthplace of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? That don't make no sense. So I said no, right? That's the logical answer. And then we just started talking with this guy. Then we started faxing back and forth with this guy's office. Long short, about 18 months later, July of 2005, we brought the chief minister and his sons, his family, to the United States. We put him up in the Fairmont, and he would not, our own embassy and our own people in Pakistan did not talk to him, even though he was freely elected as an Islamist. And we got him an invitation, we got him the visa, and we brought him over. And then we paid to put him up in the Fairmont Hotel down in Washington. Got him his own suite. Paid $300 a night for all of his entourage. Try telling a Christian donor that you're building the kingdom by paying for $300 a night for Islamists to stay at the Fairmont. But you know what? That's respect. That's respect. No paper plates there. So we started to have a conversation. The very first time I sat down with him, I said, and then I flew to Chicago to show respect because somehow got a flight to Chicago. I flew out there. I don't want to do this. I don't have any time for this. So I could greet him as he came off the plane. We worked out all the protocol with all the airlines and the airports. I mean, just tried doing this. It's no fun. And flew back with him to Washington. And then he got his rest. And then the next day I said to him, why are you doing this? Why are you in politics? And his answer was simply this. He said, I believe that on the last day, my Creator will judge me and hold me accountable for my actions on earth. I said, brother, we disagree on some things theologically, but on that point, we can work together. And that's what happened. We spent 10 days. I took him to see the National Security Council. I took him to the Pentagon. I took him to Maryland's Eastern Shore, to a sort of a retreat center, talking about Islam, talking about Christ, what it means for them, how Jesus, all these kinds of things. Pakistani restaurants at the Yin Yang. And because of that experience, he invited us back to Pakistan in October of 2005. And the day after the earthquake, if you remember when 139,000 people were killed, this is October 9th, 2005. It was his province that got hit. He's coordinating the entire response, but he's saying, I want to make time to sign a memorandum of understanding with you to work on religious freedom together in a very holistic way. Now, that's not me, folks. That's me being stupid enough to think that the principles that Christ gave are practical. Because I'm not going in with money. I got none. I'm not going in with the military. Don't have any of that. I'm just going in with this love thing. And it's not touchy-feely when you're in Pakistan's northwest frontier province. So what happens because of this agreement on 9 October 2005? This past May, I was back at the Pearl Continental, you can see on the podium there, and we did a conference under the Chief Minister's auspices on peace and religion. It was the first time in the history of the Northwest Frontier Province that all five religions were in the same place at the same time. Sikh, Hindu, Shia, Christian, Sunni, Muslim. And you know what the metric for success was for all those worried about quantitative measures? Is that the Sikh, Hindu, Shia, and Christian took twice their allotted time. Why is that significant? Because they'd never been given the opportunity to speak to their fellow Pashtun Pakistani brothers. In the audience were 40 imams from the province and the student leaders from all the universities. We had 185 people in that room. And it was just people of faith sharing how their faith contributes to social stability, but to civil society. And it was a chance for minorities. Christians, for example, are 0.04% of that population. 50,000 among 20 million conservative Pashto Pakistani Muslims. And it was a chance to say, hey, we're Pakistani too. We live here with you. We're your neighbor. This is what it means to have a public square when one didn't exist beforehand. Now, is that just a conference? Sure. But it had never taken place before. It's waiting to be expanded and deepened for the tent to be enlarged, as Isaiah says in chapter 54, 52. Here's another example. This is the Dean of Islamic Theology at Peshawar University, a dear, dear brother in humanity. And what you see there is the cornerstone of a church that's been refurbished. It's illegal to build churches in Pakistan because it's an Islamic state. And the church at Peshawar University, which dates back to British times, had fallen into disrepair. So the church wanted to refurbish it, and the university officials and the local officials said no. But the chief minister said yes. And the bishop said to us, the only reason this is taking place is because you've engaged him and showed a different kind of love from Christians outside Pakistan. And the Sharia court basically said when they ruled on it, because the chief minister got sued by his fellow Muslims. And the Sharia court basically said, if Chief Minister Durrani says it's okay, then it's okay with us. Now, how many of you read about this in the newspapers? How many of you saw this on Fox News? Loving your neighbor can be practical. But you've also got to engage bottom up. And this takes you to a whole different kind of place as Magoo. And this is the number one, the largest madrasa in Peshawar. This is Maulana Banuri. I meet with him when I go there. You know, all these guys think 9/11 was done by CIA, Mossad, and the Jews, of course. And you just got to let that one go. And then you engage and say, okay, let's talk. Let's get to know each other. What does respect look like? In this conversation, he said something to me as we left that I thought about for a year and a half until I came back to see him. He said, you know, you Americans, you want respect, but we want tenderness. Very candid moment. I had no idea what he meant by that. So I came back, and you know, you build the relationship and you deepen the relationship. And I went back to him in May of last year, and I said, "Hey, this has been bothering me for a long time. What do you mean?" He said, "We all know you're the great superpower. We all know that you're going to interfere in domestic affairs around the world because that's what superpowers do. Just be nice." Just sort of do it in a gentle way. You're the 800-pound gorilla. Just sort of be soft about it. We don't need the military responses all the time. But we want tenderness. You will get respect if you act this way, but treat us with some tenderness. Love your neighbor. That's what he's saying. It's practical. And here's the last thing that we've done in Northwest Frontier Province before we wrap up with the Middle East, another easy spot, is this is down in the town of Banu, which is on the border of Waziristan, northern Waziristan. And if you've read the papers at all, this is really ground zero for Al-Qaeda and Taliban. Again, what in the world is a white Anglo from America doing there in the name of Christ? The fact of the matter is we're there under Pukhtunwali, which is the honor code for Pashtuns. The same reason we're not killed or there's less of a threat to us is the same reason that we can't find bin Laden. Because once you're a guest, you're a guest, and they'll die for you. So we're down in Banu, and we said, hey, let's have another memorandum of understanding. So now our little NGO not only has a formal written understanding with the chief minister of the Northwest Frontier Province, freely elected Islamist, but we also have a MOU with the University of Science and Technology at Banu. And that thing, that MOU stipulates that we will pay or fund for a cohort a year to get a full education. And the only stipulations are that you educate men and women together, that you include the minorities, i.e. the Christians, and that you include people from the tribal areas. This is in a region where 40% of the population live below the poverty line. There's a 26% literacy rate, and there's a 3% literacy rate among women. Oh, and the last stipulation was that you develop a curriculum that talks about the Ummah and global society and how respect works in that context. Ummah is an Arabic word for the body of Muslim believers worldwide. It's equivalent of the body of Christ. They call it their Ummah. So you develop a curriculum on what respect looks like in the according to the form Islam has taken in your Pashtun culture. And as you engage, you really got to account for identity. Before I even went to Pakistan, I had a lunch with one of my Pakistani friends who's a scholar, and you've seen him on TV, Akbar Ahmed. And the first thing he said to me was, you know, I've been a Muslim. I've been a Pashtun for 3,000 years. I've been a Muslim for 1,400 and a Pakistani for 60. That's how he thinks about him. That's how they think about him themselves. You got to be able to go deep and long and have patience if you're going to engage a culture and build relationships of meaning. I've been an American for 200 years and I'm a mutt. Some German Scottish, you know, it's apples and oranges. But because of the relationships and taking the time to respect one another, I can have my picture taken with women after asking for permission. And each one of these women, they all speak English and they want to get MBAs. Now, you got to get outside of your evangelical cocoon box and talk to these folks. So your first reaction, if you're typical, stereotypical evangelical, is there's the enemy. That's the problem with Islam. But that is a conservative Islam that's trying to find a way to work with modernity. And they're being educated in the same classrooms as the men. Not that that is a sign in and of itself, but it shows that they're open to different ways of thinking about things. This picture's a little dark, but there's the men in the program. I want to point out Josh on the left-hand side. He was in an earlier picture meeting with the Maulana in Peshawar. Josh worked for us for 4 years. He graduated from Williams, and he was going to go get his MA at Johns Hopkins. And so we were going to send him up in Uzbekistan with my friends there, which is where I did my PhD work. And it so happens that Andijan took place in May of 2005, and all of our relationships in Tashkent went south or just froze. The massacre in Andijan, if you remember that, in the northeast of Uzbekistan. So I took Josh to Pakistan with me, and the night we signed that MOU with the chief minister, the day after the earthquake, I said, what if we left Josh here as a demonstration that we care about you and we want to understand this? And Josh was like, yeah, what if we did that? Like, sure, boss. Yeah. Fast forward. Josh now speaks Urdu. He's about to graduate from SAIS. He speaks Hindi. He's probably going to do a PhD program. He is Washington, D.C.'s number one expert on religion and politics in the Northwest Frontier Province. And I know few people more spiritually mature. He lived with the Islamist in the inner circle for a year before going to SAIS. Love, listen, observe. If you're interested in this, go see the April edition online of Christianity Today. April 07, Josh wrote an article called Living with Islamists. It's powerful. If you dare to take Christ seriously, if you dare to love your neighbor, if you dare to let God be bigger than your imagination, which he is, by the way, cool things start happening.
Okay, I want to wrap up. So that's in Pakistan, that's a long process. That's fall of 2003 to today. That's a lot of listening and observing. And to be honest, if I had no idea that we'd have those kinds of tangible results. If I'd gone to a Christian donor and said, these are my results, they probably still wouldn't have bought it because I'm not proselytizing. But I didn't even know what they were before I went. I just felt like this was something we were supposed to do. Hope is not a strategy, but hope has to be the initiator, and then you see the strategy revealed, and God provides. I forgot to mention this part of the story. I tried to get Christians to fund the chief minister's visit in July of 2005. How many donors do you think I got? Zero. You know who came alongside us was a secular guy who fell from faith because his wife died of cancer, and he prayed to God, and God didn't answer him. He said, but I believe in what you're doing. And I'm going to give you $50,000 to do this. These kinds of things happen to us all the time. God provides if you're trying to be obedient in a humble, frail, broken way as best you can. So, I need to engage the Middle East like I need a hole in the head. It's not my background. I've never been there before until last week. I just got back on Saturday from 2 weeks in the region, went to Syria and to Doha and to Beirut and to the West Bank and to Jerusalem. But God's been putting on my heart, disciple, this is something you got to be doing. And I'm like Jonah on most of these things. It's like, all right, Lord, hit me over the head with a 2x4 a few more times, then maybe. So now it's about 8 or 9 times I've been hit over the head, and I'm now understanding that this is something we're supposed to do. So what do you do? Well, you don't develop a program and ask the donors to fund it with these deliverables and these outcomes and these metrics before you go talk to people. You go over and you talk and you listen and you engage. So part of the conversation was establishing contacts in Bethlehem and among evangelicals, and we got a meeting with President Abbas. You know, I'd like to take credit for that and say, hey, we've got all this access. It just happened. There's some friends over there that got us in, and we talked to him and his chief of staff for a while. We also met with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We have to be very balanced about this. It's if any place in the world where it's too easy to get a label too quickly, it's this part of the world. So you engage and you listen. Here's the Grand Mufti of all of Israel-Palestine. He thinks CIA did 9/11 too. Okay, let's start having a conversation. And success the first time is that you'll be invited back. It's not A, B, C, and you know, your type A linear teleological engagement strategy that we all have as Americans, or at least some of us in the room as Americans. By the way, this is Bob Roberts. He's a pastor of a megachurch down in Texas. He's also chairman of our board. If you are interested in anything that I'm saying, you should read some of his books. He's got 3 books out through Zondervan, Globalization, Transformation, and Church Multiplying. He's a big church planter down in Texas. And he's saying everything that I'm saying in a way that reaches the person in the pew. You want to learn how to be a good pastor? Read some of his stuff. This guy on the left, Don Anderson, is from Kensington Church in Detroit. Anybody recognize that church? It's a mega church of 11,000 people. Bob spoke at their church last year and said, you are next to the number one Muslim population center in the United States. What are you doing to engage your neighbor? You know what their answer was? Nothing. It's not an accident. Engage. Kensington Church is going to be the focal point for getting evangelicals and mega churches to go over to the Holy Land and begin to see how the Palestinians are actually living, which, by the way, is not a fun place. But you got to go from the bottom up. You got to look and see what it looks like on the cold light of day and walk the ground. This is the wall going right through Bethlehem. Man, it just breaks your heart. And I can tell you the pros and cons from each side. I can tell you why the Israelis believe in the security and these kinds of things. And the irony is, if the Israelis pulled out of the West Bank, Abbas would probably fall from power. But there's good people in the West Bank that need to be treated as human beings and not ghettoized. And that's what's taking place in the West Bank right now. And I think evangelical Christians can play a role as a reconciler between Muslim and Jew in that part of the world. We've got to believe that our faith can make a difference. Bashar Awad, his brother Alex, and Abdul Rahman in the middle. Abdul Rahman is the number one Islamic scholar in Israel-Palestine. He heads up the whole, whatever, association of scholars. They're best friends. They're Palestinian. They're living side by side. Why can't we learn from that? Why can't we engage with some sense of peace and justice in this difficult part of the world? Here's my last slide in conclusion. And this is for you as seminarians, just a humble observation. We got to make the timeless message timely. We have to understand redemptive analogies. We have to work within the context of that culture. This is a picture in Beirut of Mazar Maloui. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of him. You see Bob on the left. To Bob's right is Paul Gordon Chandler, the author of this book, and there's Mazar. The author, this book is called Pilgrims of Christ on the Muslim Road, Exploring a New Path Between Two Faiths. Mazar became a Christian in Syria in 1959 as a disheartened soldier. And he fled to Beirut after a while, and he met some Protestant missionaries. Forgive me if I'm beating up on us Protestants, but I resemble that remark and it just happens to be the case. And they encouraged him strongly to ostracize himself from his own culture, because that is the wrong thing to do. You had to have a faith like evangelicals from America. And by the way, I see this everywhere I go in Asia, in East Asia, the ghettos that we build because we've taught people to self-ostracize from the culture that God has called them to transform. And over a period of time, he became a very popular Arab scholar, novelist and writer. And you know what he's doing right now? He's just translated an Eastern reading of Luke and an Eastern reading of John into a colloquial Arabic. And you know who's writing the forewords to those? The top Islamic scholars in the world. You know where they're being sold and who's selling them? Muslim publishing houses. And in mosque. Folks, that's what it means to go out and love your neighbor. That's how you're equipped to transform the culture. But it takes time. It takes patience. And you got to dare to love and therefore listen and observe and verify before you engage. Amen and amen.